So you were born in Pennsylvania, and I'd just like to know something about your background and your...
My parents were both from Washington, D.C. Just happened to be Pennsylvania. That was...
Were they professional?
Grandparents. My father was a lawyer, but he didn't practice very long. He died in a flu epidemic during First World War.
Oh, just when you were born?
I was about 5 months old.
My goodness. And your mother?
Well, she went back home to live with her parents in Washington. Which my father's parents were in Washington, too.
Oh, I see. So you were born in Pennsylvania, but you were brought up in Washington.
Yes.
That's what you meant.
For about 5 months old.
Yeah. I see.
And my parents and grandparents were all in Washington, too.
Uh-huh. Well, how did you get interested in science?
Well, that's a very good question. I got interested in my first year in college when I took a zoology course for the very first time. That's how I got interested in biology, anyway.
I didn't ask you where you went to college.
I went to American University in Washington.
That's right, yes. So you... you decided to major in zoology then?
Yes.
And did you go into your field of invertebrate zoology? That is your field, isn't it?
It is now, yes. And has been for some time.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't what I originally intended to specialize in, but within a year after I got here, I was interested in invertebrates and have been ever since.
What made you decide to come to the UW?
They offered me money.
You applied?
Oh, yes.
Here and elsewhere?
And elsewhere. $40 a month for 10 months. I never had so much money before or since in my life.
The biochemistry students, it seems to me, were getting $60 a month.
Well, I was on a scholarship, not a fellowship.
Oh.
Fellows got 60. Uh-huh. I only got 40.
I'm interested in your living conditions, that is, your personal life, to some extent, before I get into the department.
Oh, it was very simple. I had a room with another young man in a house. I think it was $10 a week. No, it couldn't have been $10 a week. It was two and a half.
I was going to say you wouldn't have had much left for food.
No, wouldn't have anything left. It was two and a half. And I ate in a co-op, and that was two and a half a week.
What co-op?
Oh, I can't even remember the name of it. It wasn't one of the famous ones. It wasn't the Green Lantern.
Mm.
That's all. But so that took $20 a month. And I had the other 20 for wild living.
I see. Well, that sounds princely then. What did you do for wild living?
Oh, movie, occasional beer down on State Street with friends. And then, of course, after a year and a half, I became a TA, and my salary went up to $75 a month. By then, some of the prices had started going up too, but not very much, of course, at 41.
To stay on the personal side, the war started. What was your status, your military status?
I was 1A.
Mm-hmm.
When they finally got around to me, I was teaching an embryology course for the Navy, N5 or V5 or some such category, and it ran longer than the regular semester, and the chairman, Professor Geyer, got me a postponement of the induction because I was still teaching at the time when I was supposed to go in. So in those few months of postponement, I got my degree and left town. And before the Army caught up with me again, I was in the Navy.
Oh, I see. So you're talking about 1944.
44, yeah.
But up until then...
Well, we got deferments at first. All the TAs did. But they began about 1943, late 43 and 44, they began to be tougher about this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came very close to being in the Army. Instead, I got in the Navy.
So you knew that you would be going?
Oh, yes. Just a question of where and in what capacity.
Nolan comments at some point during his chairmanship that everybody was leaving the zoology department going into military service of one sort or another, and he seems to imply that they were leaving the department in the lurch.
Well, in a sense, of course, they were, because somebody had to teach those courses. Usually ended up being him.
Oh, is that right?
He taught everything in the department, I think, practically. At least six or eight different courses he taught at one time or another.
Well, I'd like to know more about some of these people. I've read little things about them, about Geyer, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what you have to say about Geyer.
All right, I will. Geyer, of course, was chairman of the department when I came here, and he had just retired when he was about to retire when I left with my PhD in 44. He retired in 45. I remember asking Dr. Noland once how long he had been chairman, and he hesitated a moment and said, forever, I think. He came, I think, in 1911 or 1912 as chairman and stayed till 45. And chairman was something different then than it is now.
Yes. You mean it wasn't as much work?
Well, of course, he did it all by himself.
Mm.
They rarely had any meetings of the faculty. And he did all the budget by himself. Occasionally, he'd ask somebody's advice, but didn't feel particularly obliged to take it. The secretary of our department told me that once when it was time for him to go see the dean, he'd spend an entire day in his office. Nobody, she wouldn't let anyone go near him, even herself, working himself up into a rage, and then he'd go over and see the dean.
Trying to get something.
That was Dean Celery in those days. <yeah. laughs>
That's nice. Well, did he have the reputation of having built up the department as for instance, Hart did in biochemistry, or not?
Well, it certainly grew during his tenure. But when he retired, there were only three full professors in the department.
I meant built up in the sense of quality.
Mm-hmm. I don't really think I can answer that. I don't know.
I mean, I realize but, it was before your time.
The zoology department had a unfortunate tendency to hire its own graduate students much more than most other departments. For a while there, we had practically half the department or more were all Wisconsin graduates. Geyer was, of course, for many years interested in research, but somehow or other, none of his research turned out quite the way he expected it to. A friend of mine who was the chairman, perhaps he wasn't chairman, but he was the sort of grand old man of the zoology department in Texas, referred to Geyer once as a zoological tragedy or an academic tragedy, in that nothing quite panned out in the way of his research. He got the wrong results or the right results at the wrong time. I suspect that Fred Moos had a good deal more to say about Geyer than knew him a lot more than I ever did. And, well, I found him, as a graduate student, I found him very unapproachable.
Hmm.
And yet, after he had retired, he moved down to Texas, just south of Austin, about 25, 30 miles. He came up to the department there, and I met him. He actually recognized me, which surprised me. And he invited me and my family down to San Marcos or New Braunfels, I forget which it was, for Sunday dinner one time. He was a very gracious host. His wife had died by that time. She was a very nice lady. And recently we got some money out of his estate. A considerable amount had been left to his son with the stipulation that when the son died, it would come to the zoology department. I forget exactly how much, but I think it's in the neighborhood of $600,000.
Yes.
Which the income from which we use for postdoctoral students.
That's wonderful.
Yes.
To a public university,
indeed,
I don't think that happens too often.
Indeed, it's a tremendous advantage. So we thank him for that.
But unapproachable, you had a course with him, didn't you?
Yes, I had one course with him. Mm-hmm. It was a cytology course, very, very different from what a cytology course is now. Of course, didn't know nearly as much about the cell as we do now, before the electron microscope and before the advances in biochemistry of cell activities and so on. So it was an interesting course, but didn't really prepare me for teaching about cells in elementary zoology now.
Yeah, well. Do you think that he didn't succeed in research because he didn't work hard enough?
No, I don't think that's it at all. I don't know why, but things never quite panned out right with his research.
Somebody said that he was inept at choosing research assistants.
I wouldn't know about that.
And he had a textbook.
Oh, yes.
From which he made a lot of money.
Uh-huh. It was a very good textbook for its day. It's way, way out of date now, of course. But, you know, I have heard it said, although I know I have no reason to think this is true, that his wife had a good deal to do with brushing up the textbook. Maybe with a language or something. She had been a journalist, I think. Anyway, his textbook was really very good, and you could read it now. It's way out of date, but you would have a hard time finding an error.
Really? Mm-hmm. You mean a scientific error?
Yes.
That is so.
He was even very, very good at forecasting what might develop in some of these fields.
Do you remember Miss Klaus?
Oh, yes, sure. She was his research associate for many years. And then during the war, while I was away, some edict came down from above that you couldn't have research associates anymore. They either had to become members of the faculty or let go. And we had two at the time. And they were both two or three, I'm not sure. But anyway, they were all hired as members of the staff of the faculty. And she was one.
I wonder what that was about.
I have no idea. but perhaps the university thought there were getting to be too many of them. And I don't know whether she was paid previously by Geyer or his grants or by the university, probably
she,
by the university.
Some of her money came from the McArdle Lab,
mm-hmm.
and he had some of
them. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
One of the things, I guess it's, you remember Wagner,
Oh, yeah, it's very much.
I don't know anything about him, except he wrote some letters to Noland when Noland was chairman, giving quite a lot of advice about things in the department. And he objected to the cancer research going on in zoology.
Uh-huh.
He felt that since there was a perfectly good cancer research institute nearby, that there's no reason to do it in zoology.
I don't know how frank Fred Mohs was in his talking to you, but there was a period when he was in bad odor with the Medical Association.
Which, Fred Mohs?
Mohs.
Oh, because of his having treated a patient before he got his degree?
I'm not sure. I never knew exactly. And there was publicity about this. Anyway, it was my impression that Geyer took him in when he wasn't welcome elsewhere. And that's why when I first came here, he had an office in Burge Hall. Fred Mohs did.
I see.
But that all seemed to be cleared away very shortly. He wasn't there very long.
I thought he'd been, when he came here as a graduate student, that he'd been working with Geyer and had a space in his lab.
That's quite possible, but this was,
but there is
was
more...
already an MD. Mm. I don't know any of the details of that. Possibly Art Haslam. Have you talked to him at all?
Yes, yes, I have.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't know anything about Mohs at that time, so I didn't think of asking him.
Professor Wagner was a very, very fine man. All the graduate students were very fond of him. The undergraduates were scared to death of him. Even the new graduate students, some, till they got to know him. I think he made a point of scaring undergraduates. He was the last one in our department who seated boys on one side of the room and girls on the other. there was a Professor Bryan in botany that continued that for a few years later, but nobody in zoology did it except Wagner. A very, very nice man and a very astute man. Good advice. Very fond of him. Everyone was, I think, in the department. Of course, Burge was around when I first came. Indeed, well, he had an office up on fourth floor. He was already retired, had been retired as president of the university for years. I think he was 89 or 90 about the time I came. He'd stopped going up to Trout Lake, I think, when he was 90. And, but he'd sit there in his office and every now and then yell, Judy, Professor Judy, who was, Burge acted as if he were his graduate student all his life. He'd stop what he was doing, get up and trot across the hall and see what the old man wanted. He used to get quite angry if, after a snowfall, if his tracks weren't the first coming into the building in the morning. He got there quite early. He had a chauffeur to bring him.
Oh.
And all the older people in those days wore these creepers on their shoes. That there were spikes or something of the sort that would catch in the ice and snow. And then when you got in the building, you flipped them under somehow or other, so they didn't, spikes that weren't on the floor. But I never really had any dealings with Burge, but I was on the fourth floor, just two doors away maybe from him. So I saw a good deal of him. And, of course, he was still alive, but he was no longer coming to the building when I came back here in 49.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't long after that that he died. And the building was renamed Birch, biology building was renamed Birch Hall. Mm-hmm. Over the practically the dead bodies of the botany department, who all hated his guts.
Thought about that, yes.
Burge was the director of the Wisconsin Natural History Survey, and except for a few instances, he didn't let the botanists work at that, and they were, I think, justifiably angry about it. When the ceremony was held to rename the building, the botanists were conspicuously absent. Jude was a very, very nice man. I knew him quite well. I took a couple courses from him, and then I worked under him a couple summers up in Trout Lake, and I liked him very much. Not everyone did, but I did. I thought he was very, very nice man. And Percy was always, seemed like he was always under the shadow of Burge, but he did get some honors in his own right eventually. The Leidy Medal from the Philadelphia Academy, I think, was given to Jude for his research, and a couple of other honors that came his way, for which I'm very glad.
That's good, I didn't know that.
Let's see who else was around in those days. Professor Marshall had already retired when I came here as a graduate student, but he still came to the building every day, mm-hmm. always impeccably dressed, gray Homburg spats, gray spats, gloves, cane, and he lived down around Gorham Street somewhere, where he lived for years, I suppose. And although he wasn't on the staff anymore, he was retired, he still had an office, a fairly large one. And he was very, very helpful to me at the time I was doing my PhD research. Noland was away for part of that. He was my major professor. Hmm. Well, the last year, when I got my degree, he was in Hawaii. And Professor Fassett in botany was my minor professor, and he was in South America. So I always said I got my degree largely with the help of Judy Riley in the graduate school.
Oh, really?
She was a lovely lady. But Professor Marshall was a very, very nice man and very helpful to graduate students, even though he was retired, went out of his way to be nice to people.
How would he be helpful? What would he do?
Well, I was doing a lot of making a lot of slides, and he was very helpful in techniques for treating the material before it was sectioned, and as fixatives and stains and things of that sort. Because he was an expert at this himself, mm-hmm. and he was very generous in giving good advice. Always appreciated it. Now that about takes care of the older members of the staff, I guess.
You haven't talked about Noland yet.
Oh, well, Noland was my major professor. And, a perfectly splendid man. And, just as nice as he could be. Very, very kind. And very knowledgeable about so many things. You know, I would stew about something for weeks or months, some minor little question, you know, that I couldn't figure out the answer to. I'd finally go ask him, and he'd tell me right off. He didn't have to look it up, he knew it. And as I say, he, of course, invertebrates and protozoa were his main interest. But in addition to teaching protozoology, he taught invertebrate zoology, and he had taught at various times ecology, and every elementary course we ever had, and I'm sure two or three that I've left out. He was always the one that sort of filled in when somebody was gone or whatever, and taught the course for him. Very, very fine gentleman. I liked and respected him a tremendous amount. He was so very kind to students. On every Sunday evening, he held open house for any students, graduates or undergraduates, that would like to come out and play games or listen to music or whatever.
Did many go?
Oh, yes, indeed. Yes. I wouldn't say there were mobs, but there might very well have been anywhere from 4, 6, 8
mm-hmm.
people, and both graduates and undergraduates. Of course, in later years, he was devoted to the ILS
yes.
courses that he taught, and he did a splendid job of that, too.
How about his research?
His research was in protozoology, mostly concerned with the biology of the ciliates. And he had much research of his own and many graduate students who did a lot of good work and went to fine places.
So you wouldn't agree that he wasn't, that his research wasn't of importance, or
no, not at all.
I came across that.
It wasn't world shaking, but it was important to protozoologists.
Mm. Mm. And he carried it on.
Oh yes.
Mm. One gets the impression that of some people that they really stopped doing any research, mm. and I thought he was one of those, but.
No, I think he did something right up to the end.
Hmm.
He drew beautifully. He tried to teach me, but it didn't take. I remember there was some irritation, making me print long, you know, actually print all the labels on the drawings for my thesis.
Mm-hmm.
I spent hours and hours and hours printing a half a dozen labels. I was about to get cut out and paste individual letters together. I'd never get a whole word printed right. But needless to say, I was very, very fond of him.
Was he rather strong-minded? The reason I'm asking is that one of the pieces of advice that Wagner gave him was not to hire Emlyn when they were, I don't know whether you knew that there were three people under consideration.
No, that was before I came.
Yes. And Wagner several times mm-hmm. spoke about the fact he thought Emlyn would be too expensive and that he was, I think he felt he was too much of a field man. And I noticed that Emily got hired,
yeah.
and I wondered.
Now, by that time, of course, Wagner was retired.
Oh yes, he was, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. no, these were just—he was in California, and these were letters that he
oh,
wrote
I
from
see.
California.
Yeah.
So I wondered if that was Nolan holding out against this advisor.
You perhaps wouldn't think that he was strong-minded, strong-willed, but I think he was. Once he made up his mind to something, he was very adamant about it. I mean, he stuck to his principles. Sometimes he was You know, he was very, very honest. Sometimes he told you things you didn't want to hear, but he thought you should.
Such as?
Oh, when I wasn't doing very well, getting along very well with my research, for example, he let me know about it. And he didn't pull any punches when it came to somebody asked him what about something. He'd tell them just what he believed, whether that was what the person wanted to hear or not.
Mm. A refreshing quality.
Yes, indeed. I remember the time that he was away while I was getting my degree. He was out at the University of Hawaii, and he'd been brought there to make a report on the department, the zoology department,
mm-hmm.
which was, I believe, the had the time that he was away while I was getting my degree, he was out at the University of Hawaii, and he'd been brought there to make a report on the department, the zoology department,
mm-hmm.
Which was, I believe, the had as chairman then a former Wisconsin man. And his report was not very well received. But it was absolutely true, I'm sure. What he said.
I'm going to turn the tape
on. All right.
How were the relations among these people, Noland and Geyer and
Well, of course, as a graduate student, I didn't really know very much about that.
Well, you would have in the biochemistry department, you would have known what relations were, so they...
But of course, there were, as I say, there were only three full professors when Geyer retired.
Right, yes.
There were a number of others who held lower posts,
mm-hmm.
but... And what went on between them, I really have no idea. When I came back as a member of the faculty, then Geyer was gone. And I learned a little about how the others got along, but it was, that had nothing to do with Geyer. One thing that the department did after Geyer retired, the three full professors, was Noland and R.K. Meyer and Herrick.
Mm-hmm.
They got together, drew up a set of ground rules. Chief among them was that never again would they have a chairman for 35 years.
I noticed there's a sturdy change of chairman through the through the
indeed.
40s and 50s,
there is.
Which isn't
indeed.
The case in all the departments.
No.
Hmm.
And regular staff meetings.
Ah.
For years, we had one every week, whether we needed it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And the chairman became no longer really an executive officer. He was just sort of presided at the meetings, and the staff decided what should be done, what shouldn't be done, and so
mm-hmm.
on. And it worked out. It's worked out very well, I think, over the years. We all get along fine.
That's a question I want to get to. I have a few other things on
Fine.
This period. There's
Fine.
Miss Bilstad. I noticed her name. What was she like? She's a woman, and she stays in the same position for a long time.
Yes. I'm happy to say that when she retired, she was full professor. I think her slowness to advance and to have her salary advanced in those days probably was, although I don't know this for sure, except the time that I was on the staff, had to do partly with the fact that she was a woman, partly with the fact that she didn't do much of any research.
Mm-hmm.
But she was a splendid teacher, And she kept all her teaching right up to date. And the students who took her courses always respected her ability. I was very fond of Miss Bilstead. She was a, she had one leg shorter than the other and to wear a built up shoe. And, but after you'd known her a week or two, you forgot all about that. She ignored it and you learned to too. And she was a, an excellent swimmer. She learned to fly her own plane.
Oh.
And,
she was just an interesting woman.
A very interesting person.
And you mentioned you were going to say something.
I don't think I was.
Oh. You mentioned you to Riley. It happens I had thought I would like to interview her, but I've discovered she's in a nursing home.
Oh, really?
And I suppose she's not in a condition to be interviewed, but you said she was very helpful, and many people have said that she was very important in the graduate school. Could you describe in what way she was helpful?
Well, of course, in those days, the graduate school was just to the left of the main door as you went into Bascom, right on the first floor. And there was a large office for the dean, and there was a larger office for the secretaries, who were Judah Riley and Lorraine Montaller.
Who's still here.
Hmm. Yeah. And some occasional helpers. But really, the two of them did it all themselves.
Hmm.
And Judah Riley was the secretary. Now, of course, they've got a whole host of deans and assistant deans and secretaries and personal secretaries and all that over there. But it was just the two of them with typists that ran the graduate school in those days. When I graduated, we had only an acting dean of the graduate school. And as far as I was concerned, to all intents and purposes, Judah Riley was the dean of the graduate school.
I wonder who that was. That was before
was
Fred and Baldwin,
from Louisiana.
Wasn't it?
Louisiana.
Hmm.
I can't remember his name, but he went from here to Louisiana.
Hmm.
He was only here a few years. Yes, it was before Fred Baldwin. I can't remember.
Yeah.
But it was true in 44, and I think for a couple of years there.
And so it's Judah Riley, you say.
That's what we ought to call it.
So she'd see papers through quickly and no red tape. And is that what you mean by being helpful?
Yeah. And she was very, very nice, too.
What was she like?
She was tall and thin. I think she ran the office with no nonsense, but she always seemed to have time to talk for a few minutes about a problem, and very likely she took care of it pronto.
I'd like to know about your labs and the equipment and the amount of space you had and what the work practices were, the pattern of work for faculty and students. And again, I'm comparing it to biochemistry, where people were found in their labs at midnight and back again at 7 o'clock in the morning, and where equipment was rather antediluvian until after the First World War. So I'm just curious as to what it was like in zoology.
Well, in those days, the zoology department had the entire east half of Birch Hall. Birch was sort of split down the middle.
Mm-hmm.
The west half was botany and the east half was zoology. And so the entire staff was on those four floors, basement too. And as it we had a lot of graduate students, a lot of TAs, all seemed to fit in somehow or other. The lab equipment was, I think, would be laughable today, but we didn't think it was then. We really had quite a good microscopes and the lamps for the microscopes weren't what they might have been. But now as far as the research equipment, I myself needed only materials to make slides with, sectioning and things of that sort. Professor Meyer, who was an endocrinologist, had a good deal of more sophisticated equipment that he and his students used, and I think they had most of what they needed. Students all got along all right.
What were your sections from?
Oh, I was working on the embryology of a local snail.
So you didn't need to have snail cages?
No. You keep them very handily in little jars. Feed them little lettuce and things like that. So, I don't know, it seemed to me that our equipment was adequate for what was going on. Now, not everyone, as a graduate student, I felt that
yes.
way. Of course, when I came back on the staff, it seemed like we never had, by that time there were new microscopes for all the classes, the elementary classes and the advanced classes, and everything was upgraded. Always needed more money to buy capital equipment for mostly for research purposes. But then the graduate school would come to our aid occasionally to buy some big item or to help buy some big item. It's always a problem to this day to find enough money to buy the equipment that's needed primarily for research labs, although some of it is used both for that and for teaching. In those days, the budget for supplies and expenses, the expendable things, you know, that you used once or that were very likely to break, seemed a bottomless pit. There was always that kind of money.
There was.
Early on.
Now, which day? No. You're talking about?
After the Second World War.
Oh, yes.
When I came back here, on the faculty. There was always money for, you know, all office supplies and for microscope slides, things that are easily breakable and don't cost over $25 a piece, like that. There was always money. It was like a bottomless pit. That was not true for the more expensive items. That's always been in short supply. But now, of course, even the supplies and expense money is very limited. And we have to divvy it up very carefully. So you have enough to buy animals for dissection in your classes and things of that sort, or the equipment that you need in the physiology lab or something of that sort.
Well, that's interesting. We might as well just pursue this a bit, because that is a question for the post-war period too. The botany department, as I understand it, the amounts would be apportioned out to the various divisions, and the ones some people felt they didn't get as much as they should have, and others got more than they should have. And this, of course, had to do with the split between the field people and the microscope people. Was this happening in zoology?
No, not with that kind of money. We usually have a committee that draws up a priority list. And I'm sure that there's some people that are disappointed because some item that they wanted is rather far down the list, but there isn't any ill feeling about it, not at all. Our problems, as far as personnel are concerned, stem from when we all moved out of Burge Hall, that is, half of us moved out of Burge Hall and went over to the Zoology Research Building. Up to that point, we were all crowded into that one building. Everybody knew what everyone else was doing, and we all got along just fine. The physical separation of just a couple blocks meant that even with our almost weekly staff meetings, where we all got together, you began to lose track of what the other guy was doing, and consequently lose interest or even appreciation. And so we find that most of the people that are in field work or with dealing with whole animals are still in Burge Hall, while the experimental lab people, cell and development and genetics and things like that, are over in the Zoo Research Building. And this has led to some problems when it comes to hiring new staff. Once or twice it's happened that each group wants a different person. But there isn't any enmity, it's just that we've lost track of the other group to a certain extent. And to help correct that situation, we're going to start this fall having a, what we've done before, long ago, having a staff seminar in which each staff member, each member of the faculty, talks about his own research to the other members of the faculty and some other people, perhaps, that may come, some advanced graduate students or something of that sort. And that only starts this next fall, so we'll see how it works out.
Whose idea was that?
Two men from opposite camps drew this up together.
Who were they?
One was Jack Hillman, who was in Burge Hall, and I think it was Tony Stratton from the other building, from Zoo Research. I believe it was those two. We're not, you know, we don't fight. We just have lost track of the other people. Mm. That's all.
And this had to be voted on, I suppose, in department meeting, whether you do this or not, have the seminar.
Yes. And it was passed enthusiastically.
Really? Mm-hmm. By both sides?
Oh, yes.
The molecular people, too.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we'll see how it works out. And, we're all still good friends, but not to the extent when we're all sitting in one of those laps in Noland Hall, in Burge Hall.
It's made a difference in other departments too. That crowding seems to have, on the whole, been a healthy situation.
Yes, I think the purchasing department, when it was all in that old house in the back of the university club, and everybody knew what everybody else was doing, everything worked fine. Now they've got that new building, and nobody knows what anyone else is doing. When somebody goes on vacation, everything on his desk just sits there while he's gone. Purchasing is not like it used to be.
But the question is whether it's there's a whole lot more to purchase, or because they're in separate rooms. That it's expanded, the number of people doing it.
I'm sure they like it better this way, with a lot more space. So does everyone.
Well, Arthur Hassler felt not happy with the way the department was.
Of course, he was isolated even more, he and two other members of the staff, by being down here in the lake lab. And And I think partly that's his own feeling. But we can improve, there's no doubt about that, our relationship with one another. But there isn't any enmity or anything of that sort in the two groups.
So you wouldn't agree with Grant Cottam's statement that who said that botany had been serene compared to zoology?
Eddie, talk about pot calling the kettle black.
Well, no, this he said in the last 10 years.
Oh,
he,
I see.
Yes.
Yes, I guess they all get along all right in botany now. I have no reason to doubt it. They had some very strong personalities back a few years. And my own opinion, which may not be worth a thing, was that they were a group of giants in the department, and they all retired within a few years, and it kind of left a vacuum there without any obvious choice of who should lead the department.
Oh, you mean giants in terms of leadership, not because Skoog is the one thinks of in terms of...
I'm talking about 20 years ago.
I see. Mm-hmm. So you mean Curtis and Fassett and...
And Gilbert and Allen and... Brian.
Did you have much to do with each other, the botany and the zoology departments?
Well, we were in the same building.
Yes.
So we saw one another every day. There were some joint ventures. But by and large, not very much. We actually got to the point on one occasion of having a big joint meeting to decide whether the two departments would... merge.
Oh, yes.
And we decided that they wouldn't.
When was that?
Oh, it's a long time ago. It must have been in the 50s.
Actually merge, not split into ecology.
No, just have the two departments merge into a biology department.
Hmm. But what did you think about it?
I had some reservations. But it was the botanist who finally killed it, I think. Some of the botanists didn't want any part of it.
I hadn't heard about that. I wonder, did that come from within the departments, or was it a dean's idea?
No, it came within the departments.
I had heard that there was some talk of having an ecology department and having a... molecular buff. What is your term for it?
Well, molecular cell and cellular and developmental biology.
I see, cellular and developmental.
It's those that are concerned with parts of animals.
And where do you belong?
I'm with the whole animal people.
Even though you use microscope and slides,
because
you're not into, you don't go further down into cells.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Harold Wolf was another of my colleagues who's no longer with us because he died back around 62, I think. And, he taught for many, many years. He taught. Comparative anatomy after Professor Geyer, after Professor Wagner retired. Harold, he always did comparative anatomy, and then Harold did comparative starting about 40. Wagner retired in 42, I believe. Or 43.
43, I think. The catalog I looked at is 44, 46, and he's listed in 44, so that's probably when he retired.
Yeah. I would have, I would have said it was
maybe
earlier.
It's earlier.
Sometimes people don't get taken out of the catalog.
Oh. I don't allow for that when I make these lists. Yes, and Wolf was chairman after Noland.
Yes, right. Chairman when I came here in 49.
Well, chairmen have a lot
just
to do.
Just taking over. Hmm?
Yes, have a lot to do with departmental relationships, don't they?
Yes, I think they do, although they do indeed. Our system now, of course, is a very democratic one, and the chairman doesn't make decisions of any importance without bringing them to the staff. But nevertheless, I think by his own actions, by the committees that he picks for this and that and the other thing, he does have an effect. Most of our chairmen, I think, have been rather passive chairmen.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you.
I think so.
That's the crucial question,
yeah.
Especially in the 50s and 60s, when it's possible to get new staff. And I mean, you can push for very good people.
Of course, we have done, as far as that's concerned, yeah. Because this isn't the chairman that does this. We always have a committee for that. A committee can be a lot more active and than the chairman himself.
For recruiting,
yes.
I mean.
Mm-hmm. And together we decide who we need, I mean, what kind of position, and then appoint a committee to find somebody.
Well, how did you decide that? There are various ways you can make those decisions. I mean, whether you replace a person who's left,
yes.
Or whether you take the best person there is, no matter what he's in.
Right.
Or
this is, of course, until recent years, this was handled somewhat arbitrarily. Now, of course, if you have a position, you've got to advertise for it in a national magazine. And you've got to report how many, of course, it's always listed as a, I forget the term, open university as a, you know, that you hire people regardless of sex, color,
mm-hmm.
creed, and that sort of thing. And you have to report to somebody how many women were applicants, and a lot of rigmarole that we didn't used to have to do two or three years ago. And, so it gets a little bit more complicated. But we usually bring somewhere around three or four of the top candidates here. And then the committee and then the staff, whole staff, votes on which one should be made an offer.
And that's what the department sometimes got, wasn't in an agreement about.
Once in recent years, we had a very big disagreement about which of two candidates. And this did split on building lines.
Mm.
People in Burge Hall were all for one, and the people in Zilver Search were all for another, for perfectly good reasons in each case. But it worked out without any real, feeling at the time, but the man we do have is a very, very good man, and everyone's got a great deal of respect for him and like him.
Which one did you get finally?
The one that the Zoo Research people were interested in. He's more biochemical endocrinologist. So we have our troubles from time to time, but I don't think there's any real enmity in it.
Is it more difficult to recruit people the biochemical end of things than it is? Do you have to pay them more, for instance, to get them?
You have to pay everybody more nowadays.
Yes.
Not really. The salary differential would not be noticeable, if any.
Hmm.
So what you try to do, in addition to to paying them a salary is make sure that they have, from the graduate school, a summer, either before their term starts or the first summer, for paid for research, mm-hmm. and try and get a sum of money to buy equipment, research equipment for that individual, and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. And you've been able to do that up until quite recently.
Oh, yes, we can still. Yeah, thanks to the graduate school.
Yeah.
But it is a problem when someone retires, whether you want to replace that individual or fill another need. And it's not always easy. When Nolan retired, we tried desperately to find another protozoologist, and we didn't succeed. And when Herrick died, We did get another parasitologist. The one we hired was one of our own graduate students. Not everybody gets replaced.
Is that why you didn't go on offering Nolan's courses?
Well, I couldn't have taught protozoology. I do teach the invertebrates.
The department.
Oh, yeah. yes.
Because Mrs. Nolan felt that he was very hurt that his courses had been dropped.
Yeah, the protozoology, particularly. I think he was. But Lord knows we tried to find a suitable replacement. And either we went about it the wrong way, or they just weren't available.
Was it a field that was sort of going out of fashion?
To some extent. See, I think we had about five people here. Four of them were biochemists or cell biologists that were interested in only one species of protozoan, knew nothing about any other. And the fifth one, who was indeed a protozoologist, was such a very poor candidate. Nobody wanted him. And after that, we gave up. But there have been two or three people that have retired that have not been replaced. Some have, however.
Well, so you feel, or do you feel, that